listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people waging struggle for love and revolution.
Aguanu. Hello and welcome. This is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Welcome back, listeners. We're excited to be coming back to you with some new and exciting material after a somewhat brief and somewhat long hiatus. As always, I'm coming to you from my home in Wabanaki Territory, the Dawn Land, here along the banks of the Bunawapskik River. Located in and along the shores of the Penobscot in central Maine, and I'm joined today by my lovely and radiant co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hi, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's wonderful to be back on the airwaves with you after that hiatus. And I am recording once again from my Earth ship in the high desert of Taos, New Mexico, which was originally Tiwa land. The Tiwa people still live here. In one of the oldest continuously inhabited dwellings in North America. Today, we have a guest from across the pond, the big one, the Atlantic Ocean. Her name is Sharon Blackie, and she is an amazing writer who we're going to talk about some of her books and writings today. She's an award-winning writer of fiction and nonfiction, a psychologist who has specialized in both neuroscience and the narrative, and a mythologist with a specialization in Celtic studies. Her writings focus on the places that we, a sense of belonging and a rootedness in the land that we inhabit, a theme that, as our listeners will know, is very crucial to both Sherry and I in different ways. So Sharon, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you on here. And perhaps we can start off by just would you tell the listeners where you're calling in from?
Yeah, I am on the far, far west coast of Ireland in an area of County Galway called Connemara, which is very wild, full of bog and mountains and lots of seashores and fractal inlets. So yeah, it's supposed to be summer here, but it's raining, but it's Ireland.
Well, wonderful. In all of your writings, place is central to them. It's central to the theme of what we need to explore as human beings on planet Earth right now, with the long history that we have under our belts of several millenniums of some of us choosing to go a direction that led us away from the Earth and away from place and nature. Will you share with the listeners, how did you start on this journey of exploring these themes, particularly how did you come to write If Women Rose Rooted, which was your first book on this theme?
Well, I think I got to a stage in my life where I finally understood that a lot of my own journey, which was a bit peripatetic here and there, was very much about finding a sense of connection to and belonging to place. And I also, at that point when I wrote If Women Rose Rooted, which was about, what, I guess about 4 years ago now, when I began to write it, I'd understood that I'd had some very extreme experiences with place, with very wild and bleak places. And I started to look back at all the places I'd lived and realized how much each individual place had taught me, that in each of those places there was a lesson. You know, it wasn't always a very comfortable one. And some of these places were not places that I'd ever planned to stay forever. But nevertheless, they were, in a sense, the biggest lessons of my life. And I think that human beings so often focus on other human beings, you know, on our relationship with our friends, with our family, with our partners. And we think that those are the most transformative relationships of our life. But for me, in many ways, my relationships with place were the most transformative. So that really set me off thinking about place, about what it is to be native to a place. And that's why I started writing If Women Rose Rooted.
I can really relate to the concept of being rooted to place as a native person who is indigenous to the land that I live upon. We have a very strong connection to place, our tribal name, the name of the body of water, the name of the land that we inhabit is all the same, recognizing that there is no distinction between us and the place that we come from, the place that we occupy, that we're all deeply intertwined and connected. And I'm really interested in the fact that you chose to trace your own roots through this exploration of place and your sense of belonging. And what have you discovered about yourself and about your own history and about your future in relation to place as you've explored these connections that you have to your homelands?
Well, I guess in a broader way than just myself, or although it began with my own discovery, I think the thing that I became very passionate about during the course of exploring place and if women rose rooted was this idea, not the idea, but the fact that here in the West, we have lost sight of our own native stories. You know, so often we go looking for a sense of belonging or a sense of meaning in the stories of other people, in the stories of your people, for example. As you're very, very well aware, there's a lot of appropriation of Native American stuff over in this part of the world. Or people go to the East and they start to look for Buddhist traditions, for example. And I had a very strong sense, and always had in a way as a child, that we had some very important stories here, which were really very similar, you know, which, like your own stories, are about a sense of balance and harmony with the earth, are about a sense of deep connection with the land and with the waters for women too, and that nobody was talking about our old stories in that context. You know, our stories, our native stories, were just entertainment for children, whereas your native stories were something different and something more meaningful. And I was sitting here thinking, yes, but our stories are more meaningful too. And we have to stop seeing them as just entertainment and start to see them as maybe patterns for living. And all of those stories, particularly in Ireland, which is where a good portion of my ancestry comes from. Most of the rest is from Scotland, by the way. It's very much focused on people's relationships with the land. The land is central to those stories. So that is what I learned in the process of thinking about my own relationship with place, about thinking about our own old native stories, Celtic stories, if you like, and researching them for If Women Rose Rooted.
I want to ask about the theme of why women specifically, but before we go that direction, I just want to take a moment and ask, what happened to those stories? Why did they get relegated to the position of just being for children? And as we talk about that, maybe if you have any insights into why that shift is so crucial to look at right now in a time of climate crisis, I'd be really interested in exploring that as well.
Yeah, they're probably two separate questions, although they're a little bit intertwined. So if I lose sight of the second one, come back to me. But the first one, really, how did this happen? In this part of the world, in Ireland and in Scotland, for example, and in the rest of the UK, but in different ways, it was very much a product of the process of Christianization. So in Ireland, it was the Catholic Church. In Scotland, eventually, it was the Presbyterian Church, who really began to want their own stories of how the world was to predominate. And they were not consistent, unfortunately, with the old stories where the land and people's relationship with the land and the role of women were paramount. You know, so they came in with a very different perspective on the world. And it was really a perspective that took people away from the land and very much focused on some notion of God in some other place, a kind of transcendental God who was not associated with this life, with this land, with this place. And so that's really how, over time, those stories began to be sidelined. You know, the great, we have a story, for example, in both Ireland and Scotland, of an old woman who is called the Caillach, which is literally the word in Gaelic for old woman, who was the creator and shaper of the land. Now, by the time a few centuries had passed of Christianization, she was basically relegated to the role of a foolish old woman or a wicked witch. And that was because powerful old women did not fit with a Christian sense of, you know, the Christian cosmology, with the very patriarchal perspective on the world. So it's been a long, long process through which those stories have been lost. It's less so in Ireland, I have to say. There's a very, very powerful tradition in Ireland of storytelling, which harks back to some of those old stories. But still, people don't quite see it as see those stories as something that's relevant for our lives today, as something that really have anything to teach us. So that's really how it happened.
One of the things that I think about a lot as a non-Indigenous North American, someone whose ancestral roots are both from Sweden, England, and Ireland, is I think about that period of separation from the land as the beginning, as an essential step, really, of the waves of immigration of peoples to this land. And when we came to North America, we brought along with us both the trauma of the witch hunts and the economic oppression and the destruction of the commons. All of this was going on all at the same time, but also this very strong religious dogma that played out on this continent in a very similar fashion to what you just described of conquering and colonizing the people of North America or the peoples of North America. And what I seem to see as a pattern all over the world as a result of colonization and the destruction of both earth-based practices and the stories that go along with it is that we've driven ourselves to a new, this other story that is rapidly destroying the very earth upon which we stand, to the point where the survival of our species as a whole is in question. And so my question for you is, in your work of reweaving people to story and place, how do you see that relating to resolving and meeting the demands of the climate crisis?
Well, to me, it's about the fact that if you don't love your place, if you're not fully woven into your place, and particularly into the stories of your place, then it's very, very difficult to take responsibility for what happens there. And it's very, very difficult to be in relationship with it. And it's like, if you think of our relationships with place, just in the same way that we frame our relationships with people, you need to know the stories. You know, you need to know the stories of someone before that you can really call them a friend or a partner. You need to know the stories of place. You need to know what's happened there. You need to know how your own presence in that place changes the story of that place, you know, transforms it, adds to it, reweaves it, and how deeply you yourself, your own story is interwoven with the story of that place. So that's really what most of my work has been about. It's been trying to see people's trying to show people that their relationship with place is absolutely critical, not just to their own well-being, but to the well-being of the world around us. Because until we start to understand the places where our feet are actually planted today, whether it's forever or whether it's just a temporary thing, we can't possibly have a sense of the world and our impact on the greater world around us.
Sharon, I'm just so intrigued by your research, by your discoveries. One of the things that we've been doing as we've been decolonizing our own language is looking at the deeper meaning that's been separated from some of our words. For instance, the Mi'kma'ki word, which is one of the tribes within our confederacy for creator, is Mis'kum, and that became, you know, the single God in the sky type imagery that, as you said, was separated from our lives here. But the true meaning of that word is the one who holds all the eggs. And then the word in our language for Kichinewas's creator is the great seed of life. And so we see these beings as not separate from ourselves, but as connected to all life through a sustained umbilical connection, that we enter our first ecosystem, which is our mother's womb, where we're sustained by the umbilical connection with our birth mother, and then that umbilical connection is transferred to the earth mother. And so it's this three-part movement from the connection to the creator and sustainer of life, to the birth mother, and then to the earth mother. And I'm wondering, have you discovered similar mythology within your own traditions in the course of your studies? And if so, could you share one of those stories with us and tell us how you feel about the restoration of those stories being connected to our reconnection to the rest of creation?
Well, you know, we have that's a beautiful story, by the way. It's a lovely picture. But we have the problem that we face in this part of the world is that a lot of our lineage, a lot of our traditions, we are broken. So, for example, all of the things that we know about what our ancestors at the beginning, say, of the first millennium, AD, all that we know about them was written down by Christian monks. Now, they were written down in collaboration with the old bards and poets of pre-Christian pagan days, but it had a kind of gloss, a kind of Christian gloss. And they only wrote down what they chose to write down. And so a lot of the religious teachings, the pre-Christian religious teachings, they did not choose to write down. You know, they wrote a lot of the pretty stories and a lot of the poetry, but they didn't write down the teachings. So we are faced with a situation where we have a lot of clues. You know, we have quite a bit of knowledge, but it's not extensive. It's a bit of a patchwork. But what is the, so we don't have, for example, a creation story. We know that this old woman, the Kaliuk, was the creator and shaper of the land, but we don't have an overarching story about the creation of the universe. That just doesn't exist. I'm sure it did at one stage, but we don't know what it was. But what is very, very clear, particularly in the Irish and Scottish traditions, particularly the Irish tradition, is that women held a central place in pre-Christian cosmology. They really were the creative force of the universe, and they held the moral authority of the other world. The idea of the other world is critical, absolutely fundamental to Irish cosmology, that there is a world that at least one world, maybe more, which is kind of an overlay, if you like, which is in parallel with this one, which has a huge influence on what happens in this world. And in that other world, the power basically is mostly mediated by women. And the divine female in the old Irish stories is really the mover and the shaker. So a lot of people, for example, think that all of the old Irish stories, you know, the stories of Finn or Cuchulainn, the great warrior, they think, well, they're all warrior stories. But what they forget is that the women are the ones who are basically directing the action. And it's exactly the same in the great tradition of the stories of the Grail, which later became known as the Holy Grail when it was Christianized too. You know, okay, so it was knights who were riding off in search of the Grail, but it was the women who carried the Grail. You know, women were literally the voice of the earth. And so to me, and that is very, very clear, as I hope I tried to demonstrate in If Women Rose Rooted. So that is something that we absolutely need to remember, that this is who we were, and why shouldn't it be who we are now?
That's a wonderful question, something that really captivated me about If Women Rose Rooted. And when you spoke about the relationship between women and warriors, I know that's a shared theme with things that Sherry has expressed about her culture's traditions, and something that we'll talk about when we talk about her book that just came out as well. I want to ask a little bit more about that why women, why now question, but also in the framework of If Women Rose Rooted has this powerful, compelling element for women today. And why do you think that is? What is it that's speaking straight to the hearts and souls? I know it spoke to mine. I read it obsessively, as if something was being returned to me that had been lost for a very long time. What's going on with this book?
It has been remarkable, I have to say, because the success of the book has been entirely, by the way, through word of mouth. You know, it did not get any mainstream reviews. It's been very much a question of one woman buying it and then telling her friend that she has to read it and so on. So that's a lovely, lovely thing as an author to have happen. And I get a lot of emails from people who have read the book who tell me why it mattered to them, which is also very wonderful, even though I can't always respond to all of them. And the theme seems to be very, very much that people, just women particularly, everybody, but women particularly, feel such a profound disconnection from the world around us. And that has been foisted upon us, you know, by centuries of disempowerment, whether it's from Christian church or other religious traditions which are very patriarchal. And so also, and this is combined, this sense of separateness from the world, from the animate earth around us, is combined with a complete lack of rootedness in our own ancestral traditions. You know, the Christian church is very much a tradition from another part of the world, and it was superimposed on a tradition here which literally grew out of the land, and it smothered it. So we have no rootedness in our own ancestral traditions. We feel it as if we have no lineage, no sense of continuity, no sense of who we are and why we're here. And we don't feel as if we belong to this, you know, very crumbling and decadent Western civilization whose values have often become abhorrent to us. And the trouble is, though, that more often than not, women don't know what it is that they want to belong to instead. You know, what is there as an authentic alternative to the modern values which have created all of the problems that we're seeing around us? And I think to be able to go to women and say, look, if you go back 2,000 years and more, you'll find all of these old, amazing stories where women had power, where women had agency, where they mattered, where they were kind of the moral compass for an entire people. And here are some of those stories, and here are some of those women. And it's not in any way a harking back to say we should be living like our ancestors were 2,000 years ago, because that would be foolish for very many ways. But it again is to give that sense of continuity that, no, you know, we belong here. We have this ancient tradition. We're not kind of making something up. We're not creating it from scratch. It's old. It's old. And so are we.
One of the things that we had to do here in relation to reclaiming some of our truths is we had to start remembering who we were as Skijinawi Apid, as Indigenous women to this land. We had some old wampum belts that had stories in them that we weren't able to read. And so what the people did here, part of that remembering, was similar to something that you talked about, which is recognizing that the women are the conduit between worlds, that our bodies actually serve as a portal to bring spirits into this realm of existence from the other side. And so there is an opening there for us to have direct communication. The feminine energy is connected to that intuitive, divine, heart-based wisdom. And so we started engaging in ceremonial practices that helped us to connect with that knowledge. And over time, the women who were holding those belts, who were doing these practices on a regular basis, began to understand the language that was being translated through those wampum belts. And so, you know, part of the problem is this belief that we've lost something when we are connected to all of the collective wisdom of our ancestors through the ages, all the way back to the beginning of time. It's not that we've lost something, it's that we've forgotten how to look for it. And so in your work, are there practices that you've come upon that the women use to reconnect with the truth of who they are and their own power in relation to some of the old stories that date back to the pre-Christian days? Because everything is still there.
Yeah, this is an interesting question to me, because a lot of people in this part of the world, and I think it's almost a function of Christianity and this idea that, you know, once upon a time a book was written, the Bible, which is the end of all discussion about everything. You know, that's it, it's fixed, it's the story, it must not be changed, this is, you know, we must all adapt to it. There has been a tendency, when people are looking for native traditions here, ceremonies, rituals, beliefs, mythologies, cosmologies, whatever it may be, to try to retrace as much as possible what was written and what might have been believed 2,000 years ago. You know, it's very much a reconstructionist approach. And in a sense, it's doomed to failure, partly because we don't have the old evidence, but also because I think it ignores the fact that we are different now than we were 2,000 years ago. And it's a really important point to me, to that people, excuse me, that people understand that we are myth makers. Mm. We are, humans are myth makers. You know, nothing stops with anybody. The stories don't of a place don't stop with anybody. Our own stories don't stop with anybody. It's a constant process of becoming. The world is in a constant process of becoming, and so are we. And so the stories must move on, must shift, because that imagination, that process of using your imagination, of bringing your imagination to the world, is what keeps it creating and created. So to me, it's very much been about, okay, let's go back to the ancestral stories and learn what we can about old practices and beliefs and rituals, because that gives us confidence that once upon a time, you know, we really were native to these places. But let's think about how that makes sense for us today. And when you free people up from the necessity to try to recreate something which is unrecreatable, then all of their creative energy, all of their myth-making ability is poured into new meaningful rituals for today. And it's such a lovely thing to see.
Yeah, I just have a follow-up question that I want to ask you, because I think this is critical. One of the things that we talk about is reaching back in order to claim our future, because the way that we've been living in a disconnected sense is leading to our demise on the planet. You know, Revere talked about climate change, and there's so many other things we're facing. So just the reclaiming of the foundational truths that kept us rooted to life, and being able to incorporate them into our modern day lives to guide the way that we're going to be living into the future, I think is critically important. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's very important to me to know, for example, that the old story is, in the old stories, women were often associated in Ireland, particularly with wells and waters and rivers and what have you. So it's lovely to understand those old stories and to see women in those particular roles. But we mustn't let that idea of what it was to be a voice of the wells, you know, back in 2000 years ago, confine us, because now the world is really very much more broken than it seems to have been 2000 years ago. So we have to use all of our imagination, all of our creative powers to revision a role for women still as protectors of the waters, you know, still as the voices of the land and what the land needs, but to not feel that sense of being straitjacketed by whatever, by a requirement to go back to whatever our ancestors might have felt. And I think, you know, there's another that, so to me, the mythic imagination is absolutely at the root of my work, that we take this old stuff, we take the images, we take the archetypes, we take the stories, we take the themes, the motifs, but we craft them into something new and beautiful and relevant and perfect for the world today. And I think that really, I think more and more people are beginning to see that. And you don't have to have a ritual that was cast in stone 2000 years ago to be able to walk out of your door in the morning and greet the mountains, or say hello to the crow, or to, you know, give an offering to the land where your feet are planted. You don't need anybody to tell you how to do that. If you are in relationship with your place, it comes. It's part of the relationship. It grows spontaneously. And that's so much more real than someone trying to tell you, like they have done for centuries when we go to church, you know, these are the words you must say, these are the prayers you must make, this is the book you must read. We need to break that. We need to break out of that paradigm and start myth-making.
Absolutely.
This is one of the most exciting and juiciest conversations for me in my life in general, and to have it with you and Sherry at the same time is really so meaningful in terms of just the backgrounds and the paths that we've all walked. That here we have three women on the air together, one who is exploring native traditions in Ireland and the UK, one who's living as an Indigenous woman in her ancestral homeland in Maine, and then myself, the disrooted bridge living in New Mexico, who is from Maine originally and has ancestral roots back to the very area that you're speaking from. And I want to get more into that, but I want to let us take a quick break for our station ID and meet those demands of the modern world. Love and revolution. took a break, we were talking a little bit about, you know, just finding these stories, both digging into the past and recreating them, being the myth makers that we are in modern life. And that really brings up a question for me, Sharon, about the requirement that we have as we're looking at old myths, to challenge the parts that are outdated or the ideas that don't fit with our modern world. I feel like it's a little bit like playing with fire, because there are certainly things that we don't want to throw out the window with the bathwater, the babies that we want to keep and cherish and recreate. But there's also a lot of things that we inherit that are really not very functional. And one of the things I'd like to bring up at this point in the show is Joseph Campbell, an amazing theorist and studier of myths in general and archetypes in general. And in If Women Rose Rooted, you brought up an issue with his work about the individual journey versus the shared journey, not just the collective, which is a whole other ball of wax, but why a hero must be lonely versus why can't a hero or heroine be part of a group or a team or go on a journey together. And I think this is crucial, because when we look at old myths and old archetypes, we often actually find that the hero's journey is not a solo journey. That we see things like Frodo and Sam in The Lord of the Rings going to Mordor. That was really a team effort there, the Company of the Ring. You know, our archetypes are actually built on this shared journey, but we have a false mythology, which is actually on steroids here in the United States, and Sherry has written about this in her book as well, that the journey must be individual and we must prove ourselves as the individuals. So would you speak a little bit about your insight into this phenomenon and where we could go when we start to cast aside the individual journey for something else?
Yeah, I'm a great admirer of Joseph Campbell, I have to say. His research was amazing. But he was very much a man of his time, and he was a man of his time. And so he was caught up, like, you know, like so many fine people were, in the mythology, that the cultural mythology that surrounded him. And so he brought that to his analysis of the hero's journey. And that cultural mythology that we all are told, you know, is how the world is, includes a very competitive and individualistic streak. You know, the myth of the hero is in modern times has been about being better than everybody else, not just being the best you can be, but being better than everybody else. And I think this thread came through Campbell's work, and so or Campbell's analysis rather of the hero's journey and the ideas that he brought to it. And in If Women Rose Rooted, my question was, well, okay, that's a hero's journey, but, you know, what would it be to be a heroine's journey? Because I don't want to behave like that. That's not what comes naturally to me as a woman. It may be a straitjacket that I'm forced into, you know, by my culture, but that's not the way I want to work. That's not the way women normally work. Women normally work from a much more intuitive perspective. Yeah, we do, you know, we don't want to slay the dragon, we want to make the dragon part of our team. And it's not even just about women. It's also about the hero's journey for people who've stepped out of that cultural paradigm, which is so negative. You know, the myth of more, the myth of progress, the myth of individuality and competitiveness. So it's kind of like, what, you know, what is a post-heroic journey look like, both for men and for women? And to me, they're very much more about, yes, about community rather than individualism. They're not so much about great shows of strength as they are about compassion. And the classic example of that, to end with an example, is the Grail stories, which Campbell was very fond of. And I do quibble with some of his understanding of them, but that's because I come from a very much Celtic studies background. In the Grail story, yes, the hero is a knight, generally speaking, in the older stories, who is going off on a quest, normally an individual quest, in search of the Grail. But in the French romances and the German Grail romances, he achieves the Grail not by cutting off the head of a dragon, not by force of arms, not by individualism, but by asking the wounded king, the Fisher King, what ails thee? That is the question And it's interesting in all of those stories that it's women who are constantly coming out of the woodwork and telling the hero when he's got it wrong, when he's off on the wrong track. But it's that compassionate question. It's not an act of battle that allows the knight access to the Grail and heals the wound of the Fisher King, and in doing so heals the wasteland. So, you know, this is a different perspective on the Grail story. Campbell was coming at it, as I said, you know, with the ideas that we have had ingrained into us in our culture. But actually, if you come at it from the original perspective, that wasn't it at all. So my interest is very much, yes, for men and for women, in what comes after the hero's journey.
I'm really interested in this aspect. We talked a little bit about this before we went on air, and I was really intrigued by this question being asked. One of the things that I think about in relation to this are things that I've actually talked about and written about and taught about, which is the relationship between the masculine and feminine energies, not as gender-specific mm-hmm. energies, but just as divine energies that carry specific characteristics. And so when I think about this hero's journey, the stories and the mythology that are connected to that, it's been really framed within a masculine paradigm through the paradigm of the patriarchy. But when I think about it from my own perspective in regard to my own traditional stories, it reminds me of the connection that we have between the word mishun, which means my heart, and musamol, which is grandfather. That the teaching that goes along with that is that the women carry the heart-based teachings, and that a man is not able to wear that name of musamol, which is a word that is derived from mishun, the heart, until he has gone through this process of learning from the woman how to be connected to that heart-based wisdom. And so the journey really takes place within that individual of reconnecting with and rerooting within himself the balanced feminine energies that connect him to his heart. And so when you talk about the Fisher King and how, you know, he's asked what ails you, really this is about the disconnection that has taken place, that has separated us into these polarities of, you know, masculine and feminine, and how we have been ruled largely by the patriarchal masculine energies without the good advice of the divine feminine heart-based wisdom, that this is a journey that we all have to take individually, but it's part of the collective journey simultaneously. And so rather than polarizing the two, again, I view it as a recognition of the symbiosis of the process and how, you know, we're all traveling the distance between our heads and our hearts, no matter, you know, how we identify along the path, and that we're doing that as a society, as a whole at the same time. And so it's really intriguing to me to think about how we knew all of these things and we've forgotten them. And now we're remembering, you know, like literally remembering our heads and our hearts, reconnecting ourselves to heart-based wisdom. And part of that process is in the rise of that divine feminine energy and the characteristics associated with it, which I find can become confusing in this day and age of identity politics, that we need to recognize that there's a characteristic energy associated with these things that can be embodied by all people, regardless of how you identify in relation to gender. I'd love to hear your thoughts about that, about how there's a challenge here to be careful not to create another polarity or another division, that we can recognize the truth in these stories and how they have been distorted, while also recognizing that there is a place for merging of the stories into a more whole, full image of what our potential truly is as human beings.
Clearly, that's a very, very complex one, and it's hard to do it justice in a short period of time without people feeling that perhaps you haven't necessarily, you know, given their perspective as much time as it warrants. But I would just say this, that to our ancestors, nevertheless, our ancestors, the Celtic stories are very much based on women as a creative power, and gender politics apart, the fact that women give birth biologically, which is a difference, of women compared to men, if I can do the very simple comparison for the time being, is what undoubtedly led to a lot of those stories about the roles of women being very, very creative. So it wasn't in any way to suggest that men couldn't be creative too, but that this was just a defining characteristic of, of a woman. And so inevitably it comes into the mythology. But I think to me what is interesting in the way that women are portrayed in the Irish mythology, in the wider Celtic mythology, is that it's not just, yes, it's very much about a heart, driven from the heart and driven from a sense of compassion, driven from a sense of love, but it's also very fierce. So it doesn't, it's not afraid of wrath. And I don't mean by that, rage and anger and just lashing out, but it's not afraid of righteous wrath, which is no, you may not do this. You are forbidden from doing this. And that expression of it is beautifully done in some of the Grail stories. So the myth of Parsifal, the German later Grail romance of Parsifal, you have this wonderful character, Kundry, who is a hag. She's what we call a loathly lady. And she basically lays into Parsifal, who's sitting around having a lovely time, with a bunch of other knights drinking fine wine. And she basically tells him that there is no heart to him, that it's all appearances, that he looks like a very fine person. But look at you all, she says, look at you all, that there's no heart to what you're doing. And so that that sense that it's okay for to go in and call out and be quite angry, while that anger comes from the heart, comes out of a sense of love, comes out of a sense of caring from the world, is a really, really interesting thread that I think women today who have also been disempowered of their rightful anger is another interesting lesson for the future.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I see a lot in novels, which is my field, is the portrayal of the empowered woman as the literal warrior, she has a gun, or she has a sword, or she's, Katniss Everdeen in the Hunger Games, or the girl in the Divergent stories. And this is a patterning that we see, that if we want to be empowered in the patriarchal world, we need to step into the armor or the pantsuit, in some of our politicians' case, of the patriarchal hierarchy. But what Sherry and I have often explored is exactly what you just brought up, that there is a deep and profound role for reinterpreting breaking down the stereotypes of what it means to be a warrior, or what it means to hold that righteous wrath, and finding it in a way that is powerful, embodied, profound. And in a lot of our social justice work, we talk about the use of strategic nonviolent action that's connected to the heart in terms of a modality that women might tap into to do some of this work. I find it all very juicy, and I find myself curious to ask you if you have any thoughts about the woman warrior through mythology. I know Celtic mythology has a deep tradition of it, and how we could reinterpret that for a planet of 7.2 billion people, which is also struggling to overcome its violent urges and tendencies and find more peace than war, and wage struggle with the new methodology that we really should be quite grateful to have found.
Yeah, I think actually Celtic mythology doesn't have many women warriors in the sense that you're perhaps, that we see male warriors. I mean, Maeve, or Medb actually, is in Irish, Queen Maeve, she is often called, is probably the exception to that, but that's a very complex old story and often miswritten, so we won't go into that. But the kind of warrior that you often see certainly in the Gaelic tradition, the Irish and Scottish tradition, is very much about this sense of no, you may not. And so the Cailleach, for example, the old woman who made and shaped the world, who I was talking about earlier on, there are a couple of lovely stories in the Scottish tradition where she confronts hunters in the Scottish Highlands who are trying to kill hinds, when they're pregnant, and so threatening continued life of the herd, basically. And she tells the hunter that he may not, he may not take her hind. And if he doesn't take her hind, then she'll let him have a stag every now and again. But it's very, very clear that the hunter is not going to mess with this woman. So to me, there's this interesting concept of warriorhood, which a lot of men express beautifully as well, by the way, which isn't about going out there and proactively killing, but just about standing firm and saying, it's almost like Gandalf, isn't it? Bless him, in The Lord of the Rings, you shall not pass. You shall not do this. We will not permit it. And that there are ways of stopping that, which don't necessarily involve the taking up of arms. On the other hand, for someone who's come from a country which has a very violent history, sometimes you do. Sometimes there's just no other way. And if you want, if you value what is going to be lost, if you value what is going to be taken by the plunderers and the rapists and what have you, then yeah, maybe sometimes you do have to take up arms. And I know that a lot of my fellow activists wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but that's my tradition too. That's where I come from.
I think that, a lot of this goes along with these illusions that have been created through the thousands of years of patriarchal rule and the mythology that's associated with that, which is that there is softness and weakness in the feminine. But we all know, especially, if we've given birth, that there's true strength in women. And there's also this mythology that, a spiritual life, if you're a pacifist, if you're focused on heart-based action, that there needs to be this timid nature, this almost subservient, acquiescent nature, which is totally untrue. I mean, even the history of Mother's Day has been routed to cards and flowers, when the truth about that was mothers standing up and saying, stop killing our sons and our husbands and bring them home. And we're going to stand here and say no to the injustice of wars for profit. We are going to say no to the ongoing slaughter of other human beings. And oftentimes it's the women who are standing on the front lines in protection of life. And there's incredible courage and strength in that. And they oftentimes doing that in ways that are nonviolent, that speak to the strength of being able to create, protect, sustain life. And so the mythology about what strength looks like and what weakness looks like has all been painted by those who have a vested interest in keeping us subdued. And I think that, the radical strength of women is now coming to the forefront, and it's being reimagined in real time by all of us. And so, when we talk about visioning together a new way forward, I think that it's really important to talk about what does it mean to live rooted, and your other book, The Enchanted Life, and look at the magical aspects, the spiritual aspects. What does it mean to live an enchanted life in a rooted place? What does it mean to vision forward a new way of being in relationship to one another that sustains life? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how we do that together collectively.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a strength that we all have, that women have for sure, which has got nothing to do really with the taking up of arms or really arguably anything very proactive. And that is in every choice that we make. We can choose. Women have a lot of power in the sense that we can choose not to buy all of the things that they're telling us we need. We can choose not to fall into the paradigm that we must be blonde and beautiful and blue-eyed all the way up until we're kind of like 70. We can choose to walk away from the stories that they are trying to sell us. And that doesn't require anybody to take up arms. It just requires us to laugh and say, don't be silly, I'm not doing that. And I think in a sense, that's sort of what The Enchanted Life was about. It's like, okay, so if you do that, if you say these stories that they're telling us we must live by, that we must buy more, that we must consume more, that we are consumers rather than human beings, what falls into the place, what falls into the gap that that has left? And to me, it's very much, again, about evaluating every choice that you make pretty much every minute of the day and saying, is this, you know, if I'm going to buy something, for example, is this something I actually need? If I'm going to do something, is this something that serves life rather than detracts from it? Is this a positive thing? Is this something that's going to increase my sense of embeddedness in the world around me, or that's going to take me away from it? So all of these things, in a sense, enchantment by my definition, you know, was never about magical thinking. It was always very much about this vivid sense of belongingness to the world and a sense of being a part of it, not separate from it, so that we again take responsibility from it. So that to me is a terrific show of strength to just refuse. Again, it's about the refusing, isn't it? It's about saying, no, I'm not buying into this paradigm anymore. Instead, I'm going to do this. And it's easy. It's absolutely the easiest thing in the world. There are some things that's very difficult to extract ourselves from, but so many things that we can say no to that will make a big difference to the shape of the world in the future.
Well, I have to say being like Gandalf and saying, thou shall not pass to the Balrog of the capitalist consumer corporate culture is quite an act of magic. And, you know, you are someone who actually literally has done that in your life and paid the consequences of falling into the pit and the abyss as you had to leave your background working for a corporation and go on that great journey through fire and darkness, as Gandalf did, and coming out the other side to someone who is very deeply standing in your truth and in your power. You know, and I think this is an excellent example of why myths, right? So we just told a myth, which is actually a rather modern myth, and we just understood your life in the context of that myth, being Gandalf. And perhaps if we hadn't gone through many millenniums of patriarchy, we would have a female Gandalf in that story. But that's a whole other story. I want to just take a moment and remind the listeners that we are speaking with Sharon Blackie, who is the author of two fantastic books I hope you'll all run out and get your hands a copy of or suggest it to your library. One is If Women Rose Rooted, and the other is The Enchanted Life. Sharon, we're coming into the last 5 minutes of the show, and I just wanted to give you a chance to speak to anyone who's been listening and really thinking, oh, I want to go on this journey. I want to go in this direction. I want to live the enchanted life that she speaks of. What's some advice to some young enchanters out there, whether they're young in age or young in experience?
I think the main thing that I would say is, and again, I have a number of emails coming in all the time from people who are afraid to make changes in their lives because they think they must have the mortgage, you know, they think they must have the job that is unsatisfying, that they know is not the right place for them in order to pay the bills. People are frightened of not being able to survive and not being able to pay their way or have a roof over their heads. And that is a really, really, I understand how, absolutely, I've been there myself. I understand how important that is to a lot of people. But here's the thing, if people know that this way of life that they're living is wrong, it's the only life we have. And so, you know, you can stay in the job that you hate and get the diseases that are going to kill you earlier than you ought to. You can have a miserable life. You can have depression, anxiety, and all of the rest of it. Or you can just say, well, yeah, it's potentially dangerous. You know, I don't know whether I'm going to be able to cross the abyss or whether I am going to fall off the bridge and end up into it. But anything is better than this deathly life that we're all living. So I think for the main thing that I would say to people is, if you know that your path is wrong, you have to get off it. You have to get off it. And then I do believe that in some way, the way finds you. I'm a great believer in the concept of calling, which was something that James Hillman, the great archetypal psychologist who who's been such a big influence on my own work, and that of many other writers in my field, wrote about in his very fine book, The Soul's Code, that when you are aligned with your calling, with your sense of who you are, with your sense of what you have to offer the world, with your unique gift, somehow or other, the choices that you face are kind of almost designed to help you along the way, if you only have the courage to take that step. So that would really be my advice. It's not even advice, it's a plea. If you know the life you're living is wrong, then just take the risk. Take the risk. It almost always works out.
Wow, that is galvanizing advice from someone who's actually taken that risk and done the leap. I want to remind the listeners that you can connect with Sharon at SharonBlackie.net. That's her website, where you can find more about her books and her wonderful blog posts, which kind of delve into many of the themes that she explores in the books in a living, embodied sense as she's exploring. Sharon, you also offer workshops from time to time. Do you want to speak a little bit about that? We have a minute or so left in the show, and maybe people can find out more about that on your website as well.
Yeah, I have a little project here, which I call the Hedge School, which is an old Irish term for education that isn't quite according to the plans of the authorities. It's the wisdom of the hedge, if you like, and we run online courses in the mythic imagination and connecting with old stories. And occasionally, I run retreats, mostly for women, in person as well. So you can find out about that through my website, but you can also go to thehedgeschool.org and find out more about the courses there.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Sharon, and for having this conversation with us. I feel like we're just getting started. And so I look forward to the day when we can sit down and have a deeper conversation once again about some of these things. I may be coming to your neck of the woods sometime in the next 6 months. So maybe I can come over and look over your hedge and see what's going on over there in the hedge school and bring some of that teachings back to our show in the future. It's been a real pleasure to have this conversation with you. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me to do it. It's always lovely to understand how closely aligned our various native traditions are. And that's been a real thread in this conversation, hasn't it? So thank you for that. I need you to be love, love, love,
love, love and revolution. Thanks this week to our guest, Sharon Blackie, for exploring the realm of myths and modern stories that we all need to shift and change. Our theme song is Love and Revolution with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd also like to thank my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, and express my gratitude that we have found our way back onto the airwaves together. It's a real pleasure sharing these conversations with you each week. If you enjoyed our show today and want to learn more about the work that we do, you can follow Rivera and I on our websites and on the Love and Revolution Facebook page. Rivera's website can be found at www.riverasun.com, and my website is www.sacredinstructions.life. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. All you have to do is give them a call and ask them to put it into their rotation. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. This week, listeners, Sharon Blackie let us rethink the whole word enchantment and what it means to be rooted in place and enchanted in life. So perhaps you'll take her words to heart and find yourself wandering a woodland trail, your backyard, or even just down the street with a renewed sense of empowerment and enchantment by the time we talk to you next week.